You're listening to RTE Radio 1. Each year, from late October through to February, thousands of starlings, in some places hundreds of thousands of starlings, come together to form magnificent aerial displays just before they roost. Why do they do it? In this special programme, Derek Mooney and Richard Collins investigate one of nature's greatest spectacles, starling murmurations.
Look at that. That's a huge flock of cells. There's thousands. And more behind us. Yeah. Right behind you.
Yeah.
And here behind us again now, there's more coming in.
It's a bitterly cold December afternoon, and light is fading over Loch Ennell and County Westmeath.
Look, they're roosting just here behind us now as well.
And it's strange because 3 weeks ago, they were on the other side of the lake. They're now all over towards Malachy's Island. Yeah.
Good feeding in the area too, I think. Yeah. And of course, all this water around means they're quite safe from predators when they're doing this.
We haven't seen the sparrowhawk yet this evening, but...
Members of the local Birdwatch Ireland branch, Tom O'Callaghan and Eugene Dunbar, are joined by Niall Hatch to witness one of the greatest spectacles of the natural world.
Woo, that's fantastic, isn't it?
Yes,
squadrons, that's it, coming in. And more, there's no end to them. They're just coming in all the time.
I'm just wondering, they're going to roost in the reed beds there, so they're just going to lock on all night long?
Lock on all night. I think that's why they change, because they must destroy the reed bed, like some hundreds of thousands of them in an area. When they're locking on, they must flatten it, I don't know, and then... Yeah. Go to another area.
It would be a serious wait, wouldn't it?
It would, absolutely,
Or maybe the sparrowhawk is paying too close attention or something, you know. Yeah. Who knows, yeah.
Look behind us now, where they're really coming in their droves.
Oh, fantastic.
There's so many options here. I guess in places like Belfast, they're more likely to stay on the same bridges, but here they have this whole lakeshore around us. It's spectacular.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, more coming in. They're actually going down into the reeds, now coming up, and there's a whole load more coming in.
It may not be as dramatic as wildebeest crossing the plains of Africa or caribou traversing the Arctic tundra.
Absolutely brilliant, yeah.
But it is still one of the most exhilarating wildlife shows, bar none, and it's staged by a much more familiar and slightly despised creature, the humble starling.
I can't believe that in Birdwatch Ireland we get so many complaints about these birds. People really seem to have a grudge against starlings, and if people could see this for themselves, it's absolutely magic.
On winter evenings, these avian acrobats gather into huge flocks and wheel about the sky in wispy displays before dropping like stones into the reed beds and woods where they spend the night. There can be a million or more birds in some of these giant murmurations. Ornithologist Dr. Richard Collins has had a fascination with starlings for more than three decades.
Yes, this brings back memories, this searching through the complete works of William Shakespeare back in the 1960s, in the intermediate certificate class long ago. We studied Henry IV, Part 1. And there was a statement in that. And it says, "I'll have a starling shall be taught to speak nothing but Mortimer, and give it to him to keep his anger still in motion." This was Hotspur's revolt against Henry IV, and Mortimer, of course, was the rightful heir. And the starling came in very handy for Shakespeare at that time.
But Richard wants to learn more about starlings.
Well, I first put a ring on a starling about 35 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since. I almost hated starlings in the net, I have to admit, because they shred it. They're tough little customers. They don't just sit there. They tear and scrub, and they tear the net. They do indeed.
Can you blame them?
No, I can't. And I used at the beginning, I used to say, oh, these awful blooming starlings. But then I began to have a sneaking regard, shall we say, because these are remarkable birds. You know, they're part of what we are, Derek. They nest in our walls and under the eaves of our houses, and they're in the big cities and the towns and in the countryside. They're just about everywhere. They are very, very successful birds. But the more I handle them, the less I found I really knew about them. They do the extraordinary things. They have an unusual social life, very strange morals, I have to add. They are mimics, whatever for, I don't know. And most of all, they gather into these enormous concentrations on winter evenings. Now, what on earth are they at?
Just some of the questions Richard wanted answered. And he began by asking Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland about starling murmurations.
Now, Niall, they seem to be gathering, oh, several kilometres from here. You just about see them in the distance. Yet all the flocks coming in seem to know where to go. Now, on other nights, they roost up here, and various other nights, they've roosted on the far side of the lake. How do they know in advance where to go? It's a strange thing.
It really is. I don't think we know the answer to that necessarily. They do seem to watch out very carefully for the other flocks. I think when we started a few minutes ago, there were some pioneers, I think, taking off first. They seem to be very tuned into this. Their survival seems to depend on watching where this murmuration is happening. Coming over us again now, as we see it, just coming in all the time. It's absolutely remarkable. So they seem to be very keenly attuned to where their fellows are, and then they come in and gather in that way. So I presume that's the way it works.
It would be very interesting to check things like the direction of the wind, mm-hmm. or how bright it is. Some nights it gets dark very early, others much later. Or whether these kind of things are kind of interpreted by the starlings. Oh, tonight is such a night, it's very wet, or it's very cold, or it's this or it's that. Let's go to such a wood tonight, or such a reed bed. But it's a curious kind of democracy, isn't it?
Well, it is. I suppose that we don't know how they do it. Nobody seems to make the decisions. It just seems to be a group mentality, a collective decision. Nobody's in charge of these flocks. They just seem to have a mind of their own. Certainly, I know that the levels of light do seem to play a role in when they start their murmurations. So when it starts to get dark, they start to do this. So on an overcast evening, they'll do it earlier than they would on a nice bright evening like we have today.
But there's no sense of a Fianna Fáil and Fianna Gael group dividing down the middle like in the Dáil, you know. You don't have factions struggling. I want to go, no. We want to go here, you want to go there, who wins kind of thing. It's none of that. They all seem to want to do the same thing.
Very single-minded, absolutely. It's like the way that fish shoal and things like that. It's just amazing the way they do it in unison. And as we said, nobody's making decisions. More coming in there behind you, Richard. It's absolutely beautiful.
It's a fantastic
right now.
View here tonight, isn't it? It's marvellous.
The numbers
still.
Here. There's hundreds of thousands.
And the sheer noise of them as they come over. Think of the energy. I mean, all those kilowatts. But do you think that energy came out of the soil of Ireland? The creepy crawlies crawling around in the fields under the cattle are eaten by the starlings, and the starlings then lay into their fats, and when it comes at dusk they head off, and all that energy from the soil is up there in the air, and you hear the whir of it as it goes by. It's a great feeling, isn't it?
It really is. And I think that whole cycle of life is so important, the part of the food chain. If you just think all of these starlings around us, and there are literally hundreds of thousands above us right now, Richard, the amount of pests that they control and eat in the farmland around here, it's absolutely amazing. The calories being burned up right now, it's quite overwhelming, actually.
It's an enormous service they do. And then, of course, they deposit vast quantities of dung into the water. I remember I used to watch them in Ballinafa long ago, and they used to land on the reed beds at night. But they put down so much dung that the poor old reed beds folded, and that was the end of that. I don't think they go there anymore.
Well, luckily here at Loch Ennell we have very extensive reed beds, so it seems that they do move around, maybe for that reason. If they stayed in one area too long, it would be fouled. Certainly because of those droppings and the copious amounts of them, we get more complaints about starlings into Bird of Charon than almost any other bird. I think only the magpie would beat them in terms of numbers of complaints. But if people could see what this site is like right now, they wouldn't complain. It's one of the most amazing spectacles in nature, if you ask me.
Niall, how would you know a starling if you met one?
Starlings are medium-sized, all dark birds, fairly nondescript unless you see them in really good light, because there's this lovely iridescent colour on them, shining lovely purples and greens and bronzes, speckled in the breeding season, really very interesting from that point of view, but you have to really look closely to appreciate that. One of the best ways to recognise them, particularly in the wintertime, is that they gather together in these enormous flocks, these murmurations, and that's one of the great spectacles of nature.
The history of the starling in Ireland is rather checkered.
It is. It was long persecuted as an agricultural pest, but it actually has a great use in farming, controlling pests and so on. Certainly as a species, it had been on the decline for quite a while, and this is actually something we've been seeing across its range in Europe. The most recent bird atlas, though, which studied the birds of Ireland between 2007 and 2011, it actually found that although starlings were declining quite significantly in Britain, the population in Ireland was holding its own, and the density of starlings nesting in Ireland are actually much higher now than they are in Britain, which was a big surprise to me, I have to say. We would estimate that there are about 400,000 to 500,000 pairs of starlings nesting in Ireland each summer. And of course, they would all have babies that would come and join the parents in the autumn to form these flocks. But then in the winters, the numbers are swollen quite significantly by an influx of foreign starlings that look identical. They seem to come from ringer recoveries, at least. They come mainly from the Baltic Sea region. So the Baltic states, Kaliningrad, the main part of Russia as well, those areas. And they join these big flocks in the winter too. So a lot of the starlings we're watching at Loch Ennell will have come a big distance to get here. Certainly we know from the literature and from authors in the past that the murmurations were much bigger than they are today. And certainly the murmurations when people want to see big numbers, they have to go to specific locations for them. In previous centuries, it would have been a much more frequent sight around Ireland. I think as agriculture has changed, that's had a big effect on starling populations. Certainly, they're nowhere near as common as they would have been 100, 200, 300 years ago. I think the decline in numbers of horses, for example, has played a role in that. The decline in tillage farming has probably played a role in that too. Silage monoculture isn't quite so conducive to life for starlings. But having said that, the numbers here in Ireland are holding their own better than they are in many other European countries. So we're doing quite well.
It seems to live very differently from other birds. If you take the thrushes, about the same size, living in a similar kind of way, the starling does his own thing, and it's a very strange and unusual thing, but it's highly successful.
It is that they would gather together in such huge numbers is quite unusual. Most birds don't do that in the winter. You do get finches gathering in flocks. You even get some of the thrushes gathering together in small groups or in smallish flocks, but nothing like the starlings do. And they form these feeding parties. They go out in the morning and they scour the fields looking for food, invertebrates, things like leather jackets and beetle larvae and things that they can find in the ground. Then in the evening they gather together in these big murmurations. They also tend to be far less territorial than other birds. There's a lot of squabbling around the nest sites, but they will nest in proximity to their own kind, which lots of other birds like robins and blue tits just won't do. So it is quite a different strategy, but it seems to work for them.
Now, they say that they synchronise the nesting. They are communal. You mentioned the social side of starlings, and they are very social birds. Why did they choose to nest in these kind of colonies?
Well, it's the same as, I suppose, with the theories for how the murmurations might happen. One of the theories, of course, is that there's safety in numbers. It seems to be that the larger the breeding colony, the higher the productivity and the more chicks are produced. House sparrows are very similar in that respect as well. Another bird where the territorial boundaries seem to have broken down. It may be that larger numbers can watch for predators. They may be able to drive those predators away and protect the chicks. It doesn't be a very important part of their makeup. Quite why they do it and so many other birds don't, we're not sure. But certainly they do seem to like to nest inside structures, inside cavities, inside caves, inside attics, inside church spires. So perhaps there isn't such a pressure on them for nest sites as there would be for many other species.
Now, there seems to be a downside to this communal nesting because infidelity is widespread. And laying eggs in other people's nests and having them raise your chicks is widespread, and various ones have several wives and all this kind of thing. So there are swings and roundabouts here. There may be extra security, but there's a price to be paid for. It's rather like our cities, isn't it?
Well indeed. And more and more is being understood about birds and their behaviour. This isn't limited to starlings, of course. A lot of birds are far less faithful than we might think. Swallows spring to mind. That's another bird that lives in a very similar way in that regard. I suppose from a genetic point of view and a survival point of view, it comes down to not having all your eggs in the one basket or in the one nest, I suppose I should say. If something happens to your main nest where your offspring are and you're there with your partner, if that's destroyed, well, at least some of your genetic material may live on in another nest. And it seems that this is what is the motivation for many of the males in the group and also for the females in accepting these extramarital couplings, I suppose.
Now, you're a travelled man in Ireland. In fact, I don't know anyone who's travelled as much as you have. You've been in North Korea and I believe in Syria.
That's right.
And places like that. You've been absolutely everywhere. Now, the United States, somebody back in the 1880s brought all the birds mentioned in Shakespeare to America, including, of course, our friend the starling.
That's right.
Almost all of them were disasters, but tell me how the starling got on.
Well, the starling, it's been an ecological disaster, really, in North America. I believe starlings were first released in Central Park in Manhattan. And within a few years, they had spread across New York. Then they had spread around the state. They'd spread along the eastern seaboard of the United States and up into Canada. And within a few decades, they had spread all across the North American continent. They continued on down through Costa Rica and Panama into South America. And it's an amazing success story for that species, but a big problem for lots of other native nesting birds in North America. Birds like the red-headed woodpecker, for example, which has been pushed out of many of its habitats because the starling, like it, is a cavity nester. They come in numbers, they take over the nests, and then they push them out. And in fact, the starling is far more numerous in the United States and in southern Canada than it is here in Europe. You see far bigger flocks there, in the billions probably, across the North American continent. So some of the biggest murmurations and some of the most spectacular happen in North America, even though it's a very recent phenomenon there. Also, what seems to be happening in North America, both with the starling and with another species from Europe that became established very widely there, that the house sparrow, they've been breeding so successfully there that it seems that even new subspecies are starting to evolve there. So it's actually changing as a species to its local conditions. They're seeing some of the populations in the desert areas becoming lighter in colour, some of the birds in the more cold regions becoming larger, because the larger your body mass, the more likely you're to survive cold weather. So it's very interesting to actually for biologists to see over just barely over 100 generations to see the changes in the populations like this. Here in Europe, starling numbers, larger than they are, they're kept in check by by native predators, by diseases, by food supply. They didn't have those limitations on them in North America. They just exploded, and it's become a situation now where they're a real pest.
The starling problem was such in the 1960s that questions were raised about starlings roosting in central London in Parliament. At one point, there were so many starlings going to roost in the area of Trafalgar Square, and a lot of them used to settle in their pre-roost assembly on Big Ben. And one day, I believe it was August the 12th, they stopped the hands of Big Ben turning.
Professor Chris Fear is a world authority on starlings. He is the most often quoted expert on the species. We met Chris near his home in Guildford.
In the 1970s, I applied for a job with the UK Ministry of Agriculture, which was to do research on starlings, and my remit was simply to do research on starlings because they were such a serious pest. Pest of agriculture, a pest of aviation when they formed roosts at the end of aircraft runways, and a pest in cities because of their roosting and the mess that they caused on streets. That was my beginning with starlings. 22 years later, as I was about to leave the Ministry of Agriculture, one of my last duties was to sit on an RSPB convened panel to discuss the conservation of starlings because their decline had been so significant. That decline is still continuing 20 years after I left the Ministry of Agriculture. And to think that a bird that was so numerous as the starling, causing so many problems, can have had such a catastrophic decline in its populations in UK, also over much of Northern Europe, it indicates that there's been some serious decline, I think, in the habitats that we're responsible for managing, especially the agricultural habitats. And, you know, to understand the underlying causes of this is going to be one of the, you know, really challenging things for people to look at. And, you know, God bless the starling. You know, may he continue.
In the face of a rapidly changing environment, the starling has managed to carve out a niche for itself and make a living despite the odds. Its peculiar social mores may have helped it.
Well, now, living in cities and towns has its advantages, mm-hmm. but there are some downsides. Now, in the case of the starling, well, he's likely to have to raise the man next door's offspring from his nest and egg deposit when he's not away. He can't be sure that the missus is going to behave herself when he's not around. So is this a dimension to starling? Now, this is the downside of all that. It may be great to be loosely associated, but you might have to pay a price. So would you elaborate on that for us a bit?
Well, there are two possible scenarios here. One, as you say quite correctly, is that there are extra pair fertilisations in starlings, mm-hmm. Meaning that all of the chicks in one brood don't necessarily come from the male of that pair. Mm-hmm. But there's also another phenomenon in starlings, which is intraspecific nest parasitism, mm-hmm. A bit of a handful to say, but it's where females will sometimes lay eggs in other starling nests. Mm-hmm. In some cases, the strange egg can be distinguished because it's a slightly different colour or shape from the eggs, the rest of the eggs in the clutch. But starlings don't seem to be able to distinguish these extra eggs. But having said that, starlings are known occasionally to take eggs out of nests and drop them on the ground nearby. And you can sometimes find these eggs unbroken on lawns in gardens. But exactly how this arises, I don't think is clearly known.
Is it like the cuckoo who takes an egg out before depositing its own? Or does the starling very shrewdly remove an egg before she deposits in the neighbour's nest?
I think the short answer is we don't know.
Now, one of the interesting things about this behaviour, I believe that male starlings hang around a great deal at the nest. But
but they don't actually bother to courtship feed the wife. Is he worried that if he goes away to get food for courtship feeding, that somebody will get in and they'll have a bit on the side and he'll be raising another fella's egg? Is this the...
I mean, that is a possibility, but the male doesn't hang around the nest. The male follows the female very, very closely when she's feeding during the period of fertility. This is a process that's been called mate guarding, where he's presumably trying to prevent his mate from being fertilised by another male.
Do you think this gregarious, loose colonial nesting pays off? I mean, all these disadvantages around the place, wouldn't he be much better off if he had his own territory like a blackbird or a thrush and kept well away from the opposition? Wouldn't he do just quite as well, wouldn't he?
I suspect that there are a lot of advantages in the colonial lifestyle. I mentioned already the release of all the young at about the same age into the wider population. Mm-hmm. This could be a big advantage in areas where sparrowhawks, peregrines, other birds of prey are likely to take naive chicks. I have, in fact, seen magpies take flying chicks recently after fledging. So, you know, they are subjected to quite a significant predation pressure, and I think this colonial living probably helps them, the survivors, to overcome that.
But paying the bills, after all, you have to go out and get food for your brood, and if you're on your own and you have all the area to feed from, it's a lot easier than if all the neighbours are out trying to get the same food as you are. Isn't there a kind of pressure by having them so close? Is there going to be a shortage of food?
Well, we don't know whether there is competition between feeding birds around the nest sites. I'm not aware of any studies that have looked into this. But again, when the birds, the adults, are foraging, they might also get benefit from protection in numbers, with more pairs of eyes looking out for potential predators.
Flocking is a starling thing. This gregarious bird breeds in loose colonies, and newly fledged youngsters roam the countryside in the bird equivalent of teenage gangs.
When I was studying the breeding biology of them in detail, the first clutches each year were fairly highly synchronised. You know, all of the clutches in the colony would be started within a few days of each other in April. So there was certainly synchrony there. And this, of course, means that the chicks of the first brood all fledge at more or less the same time. That means that they can join big flocks of juveniles that roam over the countryside. And the bigger the flock, then the more protection they might receive from predators when they're still fairly naive teenagers.
Well, now they do a kind of an about turn, it seems to me, once the youngsters are fledged. Now, most birds would look after their youngsters for some weeks, but you are on record as having studied this, and you say that they desert their young quite quickly after leaving. This is against the colonial and sort of gregarious nature of starlings, that they do this.
Well, to an extent it may be, but if the young are released into a good environment with plenty of fellow chicks, it means that they can gain their independence fairly rapidly, leaving the parents free, if they choose to do so, to start a second clutch.
But they don't do that much in this part of the world, so wouldn't it be in their interest to continue looking after the brood? They're not going to go into a second clutch.
It is highly variable in different parts of the world. In southern Europe, it's not unusual for them to rear second broods. Mm. In my colony close to Guildford, second broods occurred almost every year, but we had very few chicks from second broods returning to the colony to breed. Mm. Now, whether that means they moved elsewhere or whether they didn't survive, we just don't know.
And that's probably why in natural selection there aren't second broods, because it's a waste of time till the natural selection has removed it.
It could be in some populations, yes.
Now, the ratio of males to females is skewed in starlings. How is that? If you took the hatching, would there be an equal number of males and females? Or is this skewed at that stage, or does it become skewed later on?
The belief is that it becomes skewed later on. A guy called John Coulson from Durham University studied this, and he found that female survival in the first year was lower than survival of males. Mm. During our studies, we looked a lot at roosting behaviour of starlings, and we found that within communal roosts during the winter, adult males tended to occupy the centre of these roosts, whereas females were relegated to the exterior of the roost, which could, and they also might be at a temperature disadvantage when birds start huddling in extremely cold weather. This might give the males a strong advantage.
Yes, but then I think it's true, is it not, that the females breed at one or something, and the males don't tend to breed until they're two. So the kind of thing is compensated in a sense. By the time you get to the stage, the males are twice as old as the females at that stage, so there are fewer of them, so the numbers match, do they?
Well, no, they don't match. There are more males in the adult population. That's right. Also, the male's contribution to breeding tends to be less than that of the female. Mm. You know, he incubates less. He can feed the chicks less, mm-hmm. especially if he's one of these polygamous males who gets involved with the second clutch.
I see. Well, now our flocks are heading around the place 40 or 50. Our flocks are heading around the place 40 or 50 strong, that sort of thing. I think you published
strong, that figure.
You published figure of below 50 birds, sort
yes,
of thing.
Yeah.
6% above 200 and something birds. But mm-hmm. now they're flying around like this. And then as the winter comes in, the flocks don't just roost somewhere here and there. They all gather together into these gigantic numbers.
Yes.
Now, that seems very strange. Why bother? I mean, if we 40 or 50 of us here, why should we fly 20 or 30 kilometres to join millions of others? I mean, what could it pay us to do that? The energy of doing that can't be compensated for by the advantages of going into the big flock.
Well, starlings certainly do huddle together in their roosts in really cold weather in the winter. There could be a big survival advantage in that from the heat that's generated within the roost. Mm-hmm. If you walk into a large woodland roost where the starlings are, it does become warmer. You can sense this. Mm. Not all of this heat is generated by the birds. Mm. They are selecting parts of the roost site that are protected from wind. Also, probably trying to protect themselves from ground predators mm-hmm. through the large numbers. But roosting communally like this also makes them potentially vulnerable to predators. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got a big roost there, it's an attractive site for predators to gather. And it's not just mammals, it's other birds. Mm-hmm. Lots of birds of prey, including owls, peregrines, even harriers, will accumulate at close to large roosts mm-hmm. and take some of the birds there. Mm-hmm. But the number of birds of prey is tiny in relation to the number of birds. Mm-hmm. So by joining one of these large roosts, you can perhaps minimise your own risks of being taken.
Anxious to get up close and personal with the starling roost, we headed for Belfast and boarded the Sasha, a boat operated by the Department of Social Development in Northern Ireland. Our skipper, Ronald Surgener, took us for a short journey upstream on the River Langan to the Albert Bridge.
You can see at the minute now the birds are all starting to sort of gather up in the massive big flock, but they're slowly but surely, the old birds coming down for a prospect in below. Once it gets through safely, the rest of the birds drop in behind. It's nearly like water running. Just the whole flock just drops at once, and they start all individually, sort of one at a time, and then all of a sudden there's a massive movement and the whole lot will come down.
Yeah, it's almost as if they close their wings and fall, isn't it? They drop down, and quite suddenly the whole lot comes down together. It's a remarkable sight, isn't it?
It's amazing just to watch the whole flock just in one go, just all of a sudden the sky's clear.
You're here every night, more or less. Now, is it the same procedure every night, or does the weather affect it? Do they come down? We've a bit of rain right now. Is that going to bring them down earlier?
Yeah, the weather evenings, the birds don't tend to hang about as much. You don't get such a good show. But if you get a lovely, calm, clear evening, the birds will hang about maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, in the air, where you end up with maybe 15,000-20,000 birds in one go. But a wet night, they break up in smaller flocks and just drop straight in. But they come in from every side, so this is a kind of centre. It's not just south of the river alone or anything
no,
like that.
No, no, Belfast is sort of, it's quite a small city, so the countryside all around it, and the birds just come from all directions. That's where you get the small flocks, maybe 20, 30, 40 birds coming in wee dribs and drabs, joining the large flock then.
Now, as we slip in under the bridge, we're going to be unable to record anything because the noise is getting louder and louder. What are they saying to each other, I wonder?
Not too sure whether they're telling each other where the food is or what the idea of the murmuration is. They watch and see where the large flocks are coming in from, so the birds may the following day know to head out that direction. Nobody really knows. That's the whole mystery about it.
You'd wonder what they're doing, wasting all that energy shouting their heads off when they, you know, they should be going to sleep and trying to store their bit of energy that they have left.
It. It's
going to
be a long, cold night for them. But they use up quite a bit of energy just flying about in the murmuration to start off with. So, I don't know, it must be a social thing that they enjoy doing it.
And seasonally now, when did you first see them come in this year? How late in the autumn was it?
Oh, it'd be quite late on now, probably. You're talking maybe the end of October this year before they started to get decent numbers building up. Whether it's been so mild this year, the birds have stayed out in the countryside. They didn't need to come into the main roost here.
And how long do you think they're going to last into the new year?
I'll probably be here until maybe February, maybe end of March, before they start splitting up and moving out. Depends how hard the winter is.
There's a great effect on you, hasn't it? You'd be disappointed when they're gone. The place would not be the same without this.
It's all very quiet whenever they're gone. Makes life a bit easier when you're working under the bridge, changing light bulbs and stuff.
Are there light bulbs down here to change? There are.
Oh, yeah, there's probably 15, 20 lights under each arch.
And they must be in one hell of a mess at the end of the season.
A hell of a mess to clean up.
Well, now, they are within 2 metres of us now, just over our heads, a great curved metal structure with shelves on it. And the shelves are just full with starlings, and they're all shouting their heads off as far as we can see. They're very close to us. It's an extraordinary... You can almost feel the heat of their bodies, but maybe that's my imagination, is it? I wonder. Oh, it's an extraordinary experience, not just a sight. It's all the senses. I think I can sniff something just about. The only thing, I can't taste anything, not yet, and I can't touch anything, thankfully, but all the other senses are going full belt. I wonder, do they camp with the same guys and dolls every night, or do they mix it all up, or are there families, are there groups, are there tribes? Well, we don't know much about this now, do we?
It's fantastic. They're not even too bothered by the boat. They're only 7-8 feet away from us now, and they're all just sitting there sort of busy shouting at each other. Their moods haven't changed from the boat has come in here, so we're not bothering them at all.
Have you been here in the morning when they're heading off?
Yeah, the morning's funny. They head out in wee dribs and drabs. Maybe flocks of 50 or 60 birds will head out and just sort of slowly trickle off. Not like the evenings where they come in, they gather, and then they drop in the morning to just go, and you wouldn't even know they were leaving.
And they don't gather together and wheel around like they do at dusk, because they don't do that at all in the morning.
They don't do that at all in the morning, so just go. They just break up in wee groups and away they go into the country.
They seem to know where they're going.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, Ronald, that this is an extraordinary experience. They're an experience you never forget, and this is one of them for me. To get so close to so many other beings together in a small little space and hear this cacophony and smell their droppings, that is a rare privilege. Thank you, Ronald.
Yeah, it's no problem. Glad to be assistance. We sort of take it for granted now. We see them day in, day out. But it's always good whenever somebody else comes up to see you. You get that excitement back again, so you realise just how special it is to see them.
The notion that starlings are exchanging information at the end of a long day is not new. Richard asked Chris Fear if it had any merit.
This hypothesis of information transfer was proposed in the 1960s by an Israeli, Amat Zahavi. And we looked into that with starlings, putting radio transmitters on them and tracking them out of the roost. What we found was quite interesting. We found that males and females would travel similar distances from the roost, but males tended to leave the roost earlier than the females. Departure from communal roosts in starlings is not just one blast off. The birds leave over a period, but it's not a continuous drain. They leave in pulses at about 3 minutes apart. And what we found was that the sexes and the ages seem to travel similar distances, but there's no evidence of birds following. The heavier adult males that leave first tend to fly faster than the later leaving birds. So the longer you go through the departure period, the further apart, as you get away from the roost, the rings of departing birds are. Mm. So there's no opportunity for them to follow. Mm. What we concluded was the later leaving birds might be able to assess competition likely to be present at popular feeding sites, and that would give them the opportunity to decide, yes, I'm going to try and compete and fight my way in here, or no, I'm not going to risk it, I'll fly on and try and get to another feeding area.
Now, Derek and I were at a roost last week under Albert Bridge in Belfast, and we were in a boat underneath. And the extraordinary thing for me was that the sheer volume of sound of those thousands of starlings above our head, I wouldn't say it was deafening, but it was just enormous.
Yes.
What is all this vocalising about? Why waste all that energy pouring, screeching your head off, as they all appear to be doing? What are they at when they're use all that energy?
Some of the birds are indulging in song. A lot of them are more chattering. The birds that are indulging in song are probably trying to say, look, I'm a big butch starling, this is my position, get away. Then the rest of the noise is probably a lot of bickering over particular roost sites. We demonstrated experimentally that some roost sites are preferable to others. The dominant birds like to be fairly high in the trees and on the inside of the roost, leaving the subdominant birds to fight over less, what seem to be less suitable perches.
Just as we were heading back to shore, we were treated to the rare sight of a sparrowhawk looking for an easy meal.
The sparrowhawk just flew past here. He's done a run by, so we might actually be sitting on the railing since we cut through the bridge.
Ooh, look at that.
We'll keep an eye out and see if we can spot him again. Looks like a female for the size of her.
And she's right in position for some unsuspecting straggler to come along. Have you seen them being killing the starlings?
I've seen them catch the odd starling in through here. They'll actually sit on the railings, take a run through, grab a bird, and then they'll come back out near there she is.
Oh, look at it. Isn't it beautiful?
Up into the hedge there.
Yes, it's bold as brass. We're not that far away.
And there's commuters all walking back and forth over the bridge here, and she's not a bit bothered by them. She's just sort of keeping an eye on these birds, waiting for the opportunity to grab one.
It's great to see that, isn't it? So she has her nice meal every night with one or two starlings, I suppose.
Yeah, well,
again in the morning.
Keeps her going during the night as well, I suppose.
Yes, it does. So there's more than starlings benefiting from this.
Yep.
The somber tones of Chopin's famous funeral march. One of Chopin's great predecessors, Mozart, kept a pet starling. He taught the starling to whistle a melody from his 17th piano concerto. Mozart was devastated when his beloved starling died. Legend has it that he held an elaborate funeral for the bird. It's this extraordinary ability to mimic which bonds the starling with its owner.
So I think I'll just play them a piece of music. Now, they really like this one. This is Beethoven Pathétique, so there's a particular movement within it that they love in the sonata. So let's see what you think. Are you ready, guys? So you'll see when I start, the first few bars, they'll usually be listening. And then when you get a couple of lines into the piece, then they really start to join in, especially when it goes up more into the treble a little bit. That's what they particularly like. And they seem to like, I've noticed, when you get, because this is a a tuning in D flat major. Now they seem to quite like that key, but then they like it when you start to put naturals in, which just means you're slightly changing the pitch of the music. And there's something about those little bars that will trigger them, I think. And that's when they tend to sort of come in and join in. Lloyd Book and his wife Rose are bird behaviouralists and handlers, specialising in working with captive hand-reared birds for television and film. They share their home near Bristol with a menagerie of birds, among them five very precocious starlings.
Ding-dong. Hello, I love you.
Rose honed her skills as a nursery nurse. When it comes to imprinting starlings,
good boy.
Patience is a virtue.
It's not the only one that talks. Dennis, that one I think, he's really good at talking as
well. So you only have two that talk?
No, they all talk.
But do the females talk?
A little bit.
But the men do most of the chatting. It's the opposite with us, of course.
Yeah. I know, I'm listening to you too. But they tend to warm up, and then once one starts, usually they all start of an evening, really, when they're sitting here happy and fed.
Well, now, when you say of an evening, do they do this in the evening, going to bed as if they were roosting or something, or do they do it in the morning?
No, they tend to do it mostly in the evening when they've had their day out in their aviary and they've done whatever they're going to do, and then we bring them up in their separate carry pets, or else they fight, they like their own space, and then they'll sit there and get really happy, and then they'll start chatting, and sometimes they all talk together so loud you can hardly hear the telly.
Well, do you think they're talking to you or to one another?
I think they're just talking in general, but sometimes if I'm sitting over there on the sofa and I come over towards them, then it makes them talk more. They'll just be chatting away to you. Or when it's bedtime and when we go, night-night, boys, they'll go and, come on, hello, I love you, I love you. Then all cuts really start chatting together. I know you old chatterbox, you.
So they think of you as another starling, do they? They're imitating you, aren't they?
They do exactly imitate me, but I've never specifically set out to teach them anything in particular. Like, we have some small scales that I weigh them maybe three or four times a day, and I've just used to say to them, on the scales. And now if they want you to feed them, they'll shout out to you, on the scales, because they know that means
for a reward.
Yes, exactly.
Well, now, you've had them since they were babies, presumably, have you?
Yes, I've had them since they were, I think it's 4 or 5 days old. And I spent every single day, all day with them for a year, because they were for a feature film. But unfortunately, the budget got cut, because they were going to be an alien that took the form of a starling. So they obviously wanted them to be really good. So they paid me to sit with them, and that's exactly what I did.
Well, how did you come across them in the first place? Did you get a license to...
Yes, we got a special license from Natural England that we could take up to 10 starlings from the wild. And it was very difficult to get, actually. It took us 6 months to get the license. We keep them, and we have them for educational purposes and for filming purposes, and we maybe take them into a school and show the children and try and just educate people about starlings and how lovely they are and how each one has got its own separate personality. So when you think of those millions of starlings up there flying around, they're all different, just like people.
And you can see that among them. You would know immediately which one was talking to you, would you?
Yes, you would. You would. You'd know which one was talking. They've all got slightly different voices, and they've all got different personalities. And, you know, if I'm feeding them and they come to my hand, I know Ernie, because he catches all my skin and twists it to try and make me feed him quicker.
I see.
I love him.
How many did you say you had, Rose?
Five.
Well, now, is there a boss, a leader, a dominant one? And sort of?
Bernie, that one down there, would
he's
be
very quiet.
More. Well, yes, he is. He'd be more dominant. He's our personal appearance darling. He's really good. But he was the runt of the litter that was thrown out, and he was cold and near death when we got him, so I popped him down my front and he stayed there for 3 days virtually. But now he's so imprinted that if you film with him, he doesn't actually want to leave you. So if we go and do talks and things, we can always get him out because we know that he's really reliable. And
well, now he's imprinted on you. If I was to take him out now, would he would make strange, would he, like small baby does or something like that?
He might. I mean, if I got him out now and you held this little pot with the mealworms in, he'd probably come to you. You can try if you want.
Well, I love starlings. I ring starlings, so I'm used to handling them.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
So shall I take one out of you?
Oh, I'd love to, yes. Yes.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Good morning.
He's very eager. He's trying to come out and say hello. Yes, absolutely. Hello. Oh, look at that. Isn't he beautiful?
He's lovely, isn't he?
He's a lovely yellow bill and the blue at the base of it. You normally see. It's lovely. Oh, he's a beauty. They have quite sharp claws, but you take him in the top of the head.
Landed on my head.
They do have quite... And then they do have quite sharp claws. He's just getting his breeding colours. Yes, they do.
He's not invited by... He must know I'm a bird ringer and he's afraid he'll get...
If you had that,
there's something confident about the way I'm putting my hand out.
There is.
Oh,
there
he's okay. He's done it.
You've got the pot of mealworms. If I slightly take the lid off, then he knows to flick that lid off.
Oh, look at that.
Look.
What have you got in there for him? Mealworms. Oh, beautiful. But yes. Aren't they the pampered starlings?
Don't let him have all of
them. Oh, my God. Oh, that's for everyone, is it?
It is, yeah. He's got a whole beak for that.
Well, he's performing so well, he deserves a bit of a treat, doesn't he?
Did you hear that? Did you hear that? You see what he's doing there? He's using that typical starling scissor action with his bill to flick the lid off that pot.
They do that. They stick their bills into the ground. They prize open a hole.
That's right, they do.
To what you would expect.
In fact, when I've got this big, long flight tunnel, 36 long foot flight tunnel that I sit with, mesh tunnel that I sit with them in, because we have a resident wild sparrowhawk that would try and get them if they were absolutely outside. So I sit down there with them and they don't like me going to sleep. If Lloyd sits with them, he can go to sleep. If I go to sleep, they use that scissor action to prise open my eyes, up my nose, in my ears. It's quite a weird feeling.
What I find incredible about them is that, what Rose was saying earlier, really, if you think about when you get a murmuration of, I don't know, 2 or 3 million individuals at the roost in the evening, they're often all chattering. Now, we've just got the five. And as Rose said, sometimes when they're all chattering, it's so loud, you've got to have the telly on full volume pretty much to be able to hear the TV. So I think that's five. Imagine... I don't know, a million of them. The noise must be deafening.
The music, not the noise.
Yeah, the noise. No, but the chattering. And the wild ones, I mean, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but wild starlings mimic anything they hear around them. Mm-hmm. So city birds might... Well, car alarms is a classic.
Yes,
you hear them doing...
Phones and all this sort of thing, yes. Yep. Absolutely.
Our guys do... some of our birds, so they do the kestrel, a little male kestrel to perfection. Yep, they do the goshawk Ellie, the tawny eagle Sasha. They do the mallards that are on the pond. Would you say?
Now,
other
where
birds?
Do they hear these beasts?
Because we've got lots of other birds, so they hear a lot of other birds every single day. But they mimic them to perfection. I mean, they'll do the kestrel. You can't tell the difference between them and the kestrel.
It's that good.
Yeah. And we just got a little male sparrowhawk this year to fly. And not only did they do the female goshawk, they do the male sparrowhawk. Now, it's a very similar call, but it's not the same. It's much quieter, so they alter the volume accordingly.
They have it very accurately, in other words.
Yes. And
are they making fun of the other birds, do you think, doing this? You know, and we used to mimic the teachers at school. It was an expression of contempt and rejection. Is it the same with the
I don't know. I think they just enjoy it. And another thing, we've got a Hooper Swans that we fly at the airfield by a little old 2CV French little car that I think you may have seen some footage of the starlings.
Yes, I've seen a lot of footage for which you are responsible,
I understand.
So the funny thing about those cars is they can be quite temperamental, so it can be very difficult to start. So you'll turn the engine, it'll be going, whoa, 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 whoa. Well, they have picked that up, and so part of Arne's repertoire is the 2CV not starting.
Yeah. The interesting thing that I find is, I was mentioning earlier on about putting them on the scales, and I say on the scales, but one of the females sometimes fights with a male, and she'll say on the scales, on the scales, as she's fighting with the male. So they're using that human language, you know, in quite an interesting in way, really.
Yeah. And also, Rose had a very, last year there was this horrible flu bug going around, or a couple of years ago, and Rose got this awful cough that lasted about 3 or 4 weeks, and now Arne does this cough, so he'll sit there going he still does it, and it sounds exactly, and they do Rosie's laugh. If you hear Arne laughing, it's exactly the same as Rose, it's just quieter.
So in other words, he keeps his repertoire. It's like you learn to play one of the Beethoven sonatas or something, you will always have it, you don't shed it. So he doesn't shed what he has learned in the past either, so he has a huge repertoire, as you know.
They do, and they add to it. Now the interesting thing about them is, as you probably know, one of their close relatives is a minor bird, is the Indian hill minor.
Famous one.
Yeah. Yes. Now minor birds are very famous for being mimicking and talking, but as far as I am aware, minor birds only learn most of their repertoire in the first 6 to a year of their life, 6 months to a year, whereas these guys pick up new things all the time.
All the way.
For instance, the little male sparrowhawk that was at this year, they do his call, and they've only been hearing him for the past 4 or 5 months. So all the time they do new things of what they hear, and it can be sometimes not what you might expect, can't it, Rose? They'll pick up something you wouldn't expect them to.
That's right. But on the other hand, for the film that I originally got them for, they had to say, pull it. And I sat there with them and taught them that for a year, and they never said it once. Lloyd taught them something.
I taught Arne a word. Well, Rose tells me off as he swears. But and he does say it, which is quite... There's a film, an American film, called Meet the Fockers.
Oh, yes.
And the little baby goes, arsehole, like that. And Arne says that very well.
Well, the President Andrew Jackson, he had an African grey parrot. And his wife died, and he was a widower for many years. But when he died, he was laid out, and people came to pay their respects. But the parrot in the corner kept mouthing the most awful obscenities, so much so that he had to be removed from the obsequies.
What I think is, and what we both feel is, they tend to mimic things that appeal to them. And because they're individual characters, they will say different words. And I'm sure it's just down to what they like the sound of as their individual personality. And they pick up on things that appeal to them.
Coming up in part two of this special Mooney Goes Wild programme, we ask how and why starlings form these great murmurations, which can contain up to 1 million birds.
So I don't know why they have these beautiful flocks above the sleeping site. My own interpretation is that they are so social, as you see from all the noise, like you said, that if they come together from all these directions, when it's becoming dark, then it's impossible for them to go to sleep suddenly. So they are so excited that they have to dance and swirl around for some time. So I think they are doing it for fun.
In part one of this programme, we learned that starlings are not just good mimics, but good singers too.
So you see, there's something about just little bars here and there through the piece that they like, and then that will just trigger them and they'll start. And then once they're off, and they really join it. And you notice if I get louder with the volume on the piano, they sing louder. So they really get into it. They are beautiful singers, and they sing in key. So if you're playing a tune in different keys, they get it right. They don't sing in a different key to you. They match what you're doing.
Thank you. learned that starlings don't always lay their eggs in just one nest.
Well, now, living in cities and towns has its advantages, but there are some downsides. Now, in the case of the starling, well, he's likely to have to raise the man next door's offspring from his nest, an egg depository is not away. He can't be sure that the missus is going to behave herself when he's not around. So is this a dimension to starling? Now, this is the downside of all that. It may be great to be loosely associated, but you might have to pay a price. So would you elaborate on that for us a bit?
Well, there are two possible scenarios here. One, as you say quite correctly, is that there are extra pair fertilisations in starlings, meaning that all of the chicks in one brood don't necessarily come from the male of that pair. But there's also another phenomenon in starlings, which is intraspecific nest parasitism, a bit of a handful to say, but it's where females will sometimes lay eggs in other starling nests.
And we watched in awe as hundreds of thousands of starlings gathered for a giant murmuration over Loch Ennell.
Oh, wow, look at that. That's huge flocks out. There's thousands. And more behind us, right behind you.
Yeah.
I mean, the habitat here is just so ideal for them. There's many places to roost, you know. They don't all just flock to the one position. Look, they're roosting just here behind us now as well.
And it's strange because 3 weeks ago, they were on the other side of the lake. They're now all over towards Malachy's Island. Yeah.
Good feeding in the area too, I think. Yeah. And of course, all this water around means they're quite safe from predators when they're doing this.
So over the next 10 minutes or 15 minutes, you'll have hundreds of thousands of them coming in. Here's a really large flock now coming in on the horizon. Look.
The largest gatherings of starlings can be seen in our skies in winter, when resident populations are boosted by thousands of birds from Europe. Regular as clockwork, just around dusk, flocks of birds travel great distances to perform in nature's ballet. Wheeling, turning, swooping, twisting. A perfect performance every time. There's no room for error here. But what's it all about? And just how do they do it?
What we do in our studies is we look at the empirical data of our colleagues, the physicists in Rome, who have collected beautiful data and analyzed them remarkably good. And so what we do is we take their rules, like they interact with seven neighbors, and then we give them flying behavior, like the way an aircraft flies with fixed wings. We give them coordination behavior through being attracted to others, aligning with others, and avoiding collisions with those that are too close. And then we study, is this enough to get the flocking behavior of real starlings? And then we see that, for instance, it's important to make the birds roll during a turn. If they don't roll during a turn, you don't get the flock shapes, the great variation of flock shapes, like in the real birds. And so to use such a computation model is essential to gain some understanding of flocks of starlings, because they're too complex to just think about them. You will be just wrong all the time.
Professor Charlotte Hamelrijk is chair of the Dutch Society for Theoretical Biology. As part of her research into the social systems of primates, fish and birds, Charlotte and her team at Groningen University use computational models to get a better understanding of the aerial displays of huge flocks of starlings before roosting.
Well, there is indeed movement within the flock, and it has been empirically measured. There are two things to that. On the one hand, the flock shape, the boundary of the flock, is pretty flat. It's not very convoluted. And this is, in our computational model, a consequence of the fact that the birds at the periphery want to go inwards a bit more than other birds do. So indeed, there is a pressure on the surface of the flock of birds to go inwards to some degree. And on the other hand, within the flock, let's say in the central part of the flock or in the internal part of the flock, the core, let's say not the boundaries, there's still movement within the flock relative to the center of gravity.
What exactly have you found, or could you outline it for us?
Yeah, so we've focused on the question of what causes the great variation of shapes of flocks of starlings. And one of the causes is in the flying behavior, the fact that the birds do not speed up and slow down. And this is one of the reasons. This causes that during a turn, everybody takes a pass of the same length and curvature. And this causes that if before the turn, for instance, a flock was wide, and after the turn to the left, it is suddenly an oblong shape. Mm-hmm. And individuals have changed shape. So it's different from what happens in probably in fish schools, that if you during a turn slow down, not to avoid collisions with your neighbors, then in the inner corner you slow down and the outer corner you speed up and you maintain an oblong shape. So that is one of the findings. Another finding is that during flying, if you want to turn to the left, also if you want to cycle, if you're cycling and you want to turn to the left and you want to make a strong turn to the left, then you have to roll over your shoulder. If you don't roll over your shoulder during cycling, you will just slip through the corner. For the birds, it's the same. They roll over the shoulder during turning, and what happens is that they generate centripetal force and they lose vertical lift, and so they move downwards. So you generate a change in the shape of the flock in the vertical direction. It becomes longer in the vertical direction. Also, if you have very large flocks, then you get kind of all kinds of subflocks temporarily coordinating with each other. And this happens because individuals interact only with their seven closest neighbors. And these specific individuals with whom they interact change all the time, the identity of them. And because they interact only with so few neighbors, it may happen that a subflock of, let's say, temporary subflock of, let's say, 20 individuals move to the right all the time. And then you can get a kind of pseudopodia if you have a very large flock. If you have a small flock, then the whole flock will turn to the right.
But just how these extraordinary patterns form in nature is a mystery for physicists to solve. And the answer may lie in the areas of light and dark created as the starlings fly. Dr. Daniel Pierce is a physicist at Warwick University. We met Daniel on one of the busiest shopping days of the year at New Street train station in Birmingham.
If you want to be part of a huge starling flock, there's two things you need to achieve. They're very ordered, so everyone has to fly in the same direction at the same time so they don't crash into each other. They also have to be densely packed to provide protection from predators. But obviously there's some kind of perfect density and you've got to get that just right. So to create order, the first thing you can do is you can just say, I'm going to go in the same direction as the guys near me. So if there's six or seven starlings near you are flying to the left, you'll fly to the left. Or if they're going to the right, you'll go to the right. In order to get density, that's a little trickier. So you can't just pick some density and say, okay, this is our perfect density. Because if there's enough starlings at a certain density, the whole flock might become opaque. So instead, you might think, right, I'm going to be as far from my starlings as I need to be, such that I can always just see out of the flock. So you always want to be able to see a little bit of sky, as well as a little bit of bird in every direction.
So in other words, I want to be in there, but I want to be able to check on what is going on outside the flock, because a falcon may come flying in seeking to clobber somebody, and I need to be able to spot that falcon. And now there's a fellow in front, there's a fellow behind, and the fellow to the right, fellow to the left. Now, is it a democracy then that is dictating this? Is it a majority view? Is there a leader?
So we call this a bottom-up organisation. So there's no individual leader. Every starling, in terms of hierarchy, is almost identical in what they could do. But at any time, if one starling sees a hawk or sees some food, say, or something they need to react to, then he might fly in that direction and effectively become a leader for a short amount of time. So any starling is a leader and a follower. They can all take the same role within the flock.
Now, if you watch things like wading birds assembling into a roost, you will notice that new arrivals want to get into the middle of that roost. They don't want to be on the fringe, because if you're on the fringe, the predator is going to get one on the fringe. If you're inside in the centre, you're safe enough. You're not going to be the one to be clobbered. Now, if I'm in a starling flock, I don't want to be on the fringe. So there must be a force saying, get out of here, you're out on the flank. If a falcon hits now, you could be the one. So isn't there a kind of a pressure to move inwards? Wouldn't this be for a more clumped flock than otherwise?
So yes, exactly. There is a pressure to move inwards because you are safe on the inside, but only if you can see what's going on. So if everyone tries to move inwards together and everyone forces their way towards the middle, then of course somebody will still be on the edge and the density of the flock will be very high. So those in the middle, although they might feel very safe, can't react quickly to a hawk or a falcon because they can't see what's going on. So again, this idea of having the bird flock marginally opaque so everyone can just about see out means that even if you're on the middle, you can see what's going on, so you have the advantages of being on the edge. But being on the edge, there are advantages in that you're the first to see the hawk and the quickest to react.
So there's swings and roundabouts kind
exactly.
of thing. And you can be a bit bit of a leader or whatever, if you was to suddenly decide to verge to the left, they'll all come after you, hopefully. Dangerous thing to do, because if you go out on a limb, you might be the one that gets
exactly.
hit.
Exactly.
Now, you're a physicist. A kind of an equivalent of the theory of relativity applies. Remember, we were in the station just now, and there were huge crowds of people going up and down. But interestingly, nobody was crashing into anybody else. Now, something with a very low heartbeat and a very long life looking at this would say, oh my God, these people are flying around at enormous speed and they're not crashing into each other, because he's in a different frame of reference. His time runs on a different clock to our time. Now, does the starling's clock run on a very different time to us, and is it just a quiet stroll for starlings?
Well, obviously, the ability to fly and the speed with which they can get information from their surroundings and the acuity of their vision are very high. So to a starling, yes, flying around is second nature, and to them it's very easy. And it has to be. If two starlings were to, say, collide during mm-hmm. mid-flight, they might die. So they can fall out of the sky and die. Whereas for humans, this is slightly less important when you're in a busy train station. If you bump into someone, you're like, oh, sorry, but it's not quite as fatal. So yes, they're even more efficient than humans on the ground are, but they're doing it up in the sky in 3D.
Now, it seems to me, with thousands or tens of thousands of starlings in the air, and some of them wanting to get in from the outside or to go to the left or to the right, surely there must be a real danger of a crush. And how does the flock know to keep the thing in order and not get it any more dense than is optimum?
So again, this idea that if you're always able to see out, then everyone in the flock would have to move apart. So it's impossible to get very, very dense whilst maintaining the ability to see out. Also, what we call a local interaction between starlings is just the fact that they don't want to crash. So if they do crash, like I said earlier, it can be fatal. So the most important thing on a starling's mind is don't bump into your nearest neighbours. And then after that, you layer on the other layers of behaviour, such as the aligning with your neighbours to fly in the same direction, or the spreading out or clumping together for protection or to be able to see out.
Now, a fellow called Wayne Potts in Utah University back in the 80s had this notion of the chorus line hypothesis, as he called it, an idea he got from the dancing girls in the Moulin Rouge. I don't know if he was ever in the Moulin Rouge, but the girls all kick up their leg together and you can get a wave moving through the crowd. And he calculated how long it would take for one bird to trigger the next and the next and the next. And he found that the speed at which the signal could move if they were communicating one to one was far too slow to explain the movement of the flock as a whole. So he came up with this notion of the waves you see sometimes in sporting pictures, that birds are watching the wave coming and then they can join in with it. Is that philosophy gone in your world, or are you incorporating those kind of chorus line ideas into yours?
So it's absolutely compatible with our idea. So where you said here, where if you see the wave coming, you can anticipate it and react a little bit faster and increase the speed of the wave, it's the same. So in our model, when the starlings are spread out enough that they can see everything, if you can see to the edge of the flock, theoretically you can see anybody on the edge of the flock. If they move into one of these windows in which you can see the sky, you can see their reaction. So yes, it speeds up the information transfer across the flock a lot faster than, yes, just talking to your nearest neighbours would give you a very slow progress of information.
Now, you came up with a very fancy mathematical model and computerized all of this. In other words, you were able to develop notional starlings and produce patterns that they would generate. Can you tell us a little about that very sophisticated approach to this problem that you did?
So the model itself is made up of three parts. The first part, like I said earlier, is the notion that each individual starling wants to line up with its nearest neighbours. So if they go right, it goes right. If they go left, it goes left.
So you have a notional starling on the screen. That's a little dot or something.
Yes.
So you write an algorithm which takes into account...
Yes, so each individual dot on the screen will follow this algorithm. And then so every dot on the screen is identical mm-hmm. to the point that they all follow the same algorithm. But the information they get from their surroundings might be very different. So, for example, your seven nearest starlings may be different to my seven nearest starlings. Yep. So if we're both following our seven nearest starlings, my behaviour might look different to yours, even though we're following the same set of rules. And in our model, in its simplest state, there were three rules. So this one, that you line up with everyone.
Okay.
And the second thing you try and do is try and get at the right density, so the right distance from your neighbours, such that you can always see out. So that's your second rule. And then the third rule is what we call statistical noise. And this is a way of introducing the fact that starlings will make mistakes or unforeseen circumstances might push the flock around. For example, a hawk might attack or a big gust of wind might buffer everyone. So these are the three rules. And admittedly, one of them isn't really a rule for the starling to follow. It's just something that it suffers from, the notion of mistakes, this statistical noise. The shape they occupy is often very complicated. It's not just like a ball. Like a shoal of fish might be just a sphere occasionally, whereas a starling flock is always like a curved sheet with a very complicated shape.
Dan, I must dash into the human flock here at Birmingham New Street Station, and it's a huge flock because they're all Christmas shopping, but I'd be thinking of the starlings as I jostle on the way down to the train to get me to the airport.
The more we study starlings, the more we realise that science doesn't have all the answers. So we put it to Niall Hatch and Chris Fear to forget about the science and tell us what they think is going on when starlings form these great murmurations.
The explanations offered for birds flying into huge murmurations in the evening don't seem to me to be very adequate. If I'm going to fly 30 or 40 kilometres to a murmuration, I'm going to be at risk from the sparrowhawks flying across the country sort of thing. It doesn't seem to me that you're any safer doing that than roosting out in your local tree.
Well, there certainly is a trade-off there, but what we can see from this behaviour is that we can assume that it must be very beneficial for the survival of the species, because starlings seem absolutely compelled to do this. So I guess although there are risks, they're certainly outweighed by the benefits for these birds. I'm not fully convinced by all the theories that are put forward by this. I think that's probably a combination of many factors. Certainly, there must be some truth to the idea that there's strength in numbers. Also, the idea that the more pairs of eyes looking out for danger, the more likely you are to spot it. If that hawk or falcon does come along, it still might take one of you, but the odds are you'll survive. It's more likely to take your neighbour than it is to take you. One of the other theories as well is that perhaps the starlings are watching each other, the way they behave in these murmurations, to see who's the fittest, who's fed well that day. The idea being that the next day they will follow that starling or that group of starlings to that optimum feeding area, which could be many kilometres away from where they were feeding themselves the previous day. So that may be one of the reasons behind it as well. Certainly when we see the behaviour in the murmurations, the way that they wax and wane and move almost like smoke in the sky, that's very unusual. The birds wouldn't need to do that if the only motivation was to keep an eye out for predators. It seems very important for them to do it. I'm wondering if it's because of that constant movement, it makes it very hard for a predator like a hawk or a falcon to pick out an individual starling. It'd be almost impossible. I mean, I've tried it myself with looking at murmurations through my binoculars. To try to focus just on one individual bird is almost impossible. So maybe that's part of it too, but I think it's one of the great mysteries of nature. We don't fully know the reasons.
So, Niall, really, we know very little at the end of the day about starlings. All we know is what they're doing works. They are very, very successful. But why they do it, that's a total mystery.
I've been watching birds all of my life, and the more I learn about them, the more I realise how little we know about them. It's absolutely incredible. Lots more research to be done, and lots more answers to be got. We just don't know. It's a mystery.
When the birds leave their feeding areas in the afternoon in winter, they travel short or sometimes long distances in order to approach the roost site that they've selected. When they arrive at the roost site, they are, as I've already mentioned, potentially vulnerable to predation by a whole range of birds and perhaps sometimes mammals as well. The impression that you get is, in the tremendous undulations and flock movements of these birds, they're so spectacular. But there seems to me to be a reluctance of the first birds to enter the roost site. Mm-hmm. And I saw this at its best at a roost in northern England one year. And these birds were flying backwards and forwards over the roost site. And then about 20 birds broke off and dropped into the top of the young forest plantation where they were roosting. Four sparrowhawks lifted off from the trees and each took a starling. So about 20% of the first birds that went in were killed. That's a good reason for not being first, and maybe for continuing to fly in the way that they do. The murmurations themselves, the spectacular convolutions in the air, could also be a protection against predators such as peregrines, which are also attracted to the roosts.
Is there any other candidate explanation for that than the one you've just given?
Not that I'm aware of.
The humble starling, to many of us, seems the most unremarkable of birds. But the more we become acquainted with it and ponder its mysterious lifestyle, the more impressive this little creature turns out to be. We may think we've got the measure of the starling. We haven't. This is a truly extraordinary bird. There's a wonderful world of nature out there. Discover it here on Moonee. I see trees of green. The rainforest.
The edge of the forest consisted of high trees with an evergreen canopy forming a green wall. But underneath this, I could see into the forest where it was quite dark and amazingly open. Not at all like the jungle ads you see on television for deodorant. And from here, it didn't seem to be raining. When I got inside, oh boy.
The American alligator.
Now what we're going to do is take a very powerful flashlight, 500,000 candle power, and we're going to run along the shore here and in the marshes, and we're going to look for beautiful red eyes, as alligator eyes. And then we're going to try and get up on them, and one of the students will hang off the front of the boat, and if the animal's anywhere from about 2.5 to 3 feet up to 5 feet, they'll hand grab it. So as we move up on it, they're going to lean over the front of the boat with one or two hands, and they're going to try and grab this thing right behind the head as fast as they can and yank it and pull it into the boat with us.
Do you ever lose any?
Students?
Yep.
Yeah, we've lost.
And the trumpeter swan.
That's a wonderful display. That's a water-treading display, but the male will do that with much more sound. You'll hear him. And you see him in threat. Now look.
Oh, beautiful.
Isn't that lovely?
Isn't that gorgeous?
They create a smoke screen because we have snapping turtles here. Come on, Yo-Yo. Come on out and visit us.
Just three of the documentaries available from the Moonee Archive. For more, you can download the Moonee app or visit our website, rte.ie/Moonee.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful...